Before we get started, I want to remind you that the DVD of my documentary, The Lost Remake of Beau Geste, is now available. You can get it at Amazon.com, or you can get it from my website, thecommentarytrack.com. Go to the videos page. You'll see it. Click it. It'll take you right to PayPal. And if you go to Amazon, if you, for some reason, would rather buy it from Amazon, the price is the same, then at least click through the website, and then I'll get a little bit of a kickback there. So it might even things out a little bit. Thank you.
Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With your host, Frank Thompson.
Hello, and welcome to episode 51 of the Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson, the Pumpkin King. Got a good show for you tonight, and I'll tell you about our guest a little bit later. First, I want to tell you about a fun experience I had this week. I was invited to be part of a presentation at the El Capitan Theater in Hollywood, celebrating the 20th anniversary of The Nightmare Before Christmas. Now, as some of you may or may not know, I wrote the Making Of book with the rather unwieldy title of, now settle in because this will take a while, Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas, The Film, The Art, The Vision. And it was published 20 long years ago. I wrote it when I was 6. Thank you very much. I miss Maury Amsterdam, don't you? I've done a lot of these events related to Nightmare Before Christmas over the years. First two or three were at Disneyland, and we would do a panel thing there, and then we'd go over and ride the Haunted Mansion ride, which had been turned into Nightmare Before Christmas theme for the holidays. And then a few years ago, that moved over to the El Capitan, and we've had some really great ones. And I've always been the host, and then Don Hahn, the producer at Disney, took over as host for a few years. And this week, this past week, the great Ken Page, the voice of Oogie Boogie, was the host. And I think he's done it before, but this is the first time that I was his guest. Last time I was the host, and he was my guest. So it all comes around as full circle. And the other guest was Rick Heinrichs, who was the brilliant visual designer of Nightmare Before Christmas. And he had some great slides and some video footage of him and Tim Burton back in the 80s pitching Nightmare. And it was a great thing. The El Capitan really knows how to put on a show. And it was a sellout crowd. I think they said there were about 1,000 seats in that theater. I'm not quite sure. And it turned out there was this great slide with my name on it that they projected as I was being introduced in case people couldn't understand what Ken said. And apparently somebody didn't. I saw on Facebook a couple of days after the event, there was a picture of me and Ken, and it said Ken Page and Tim Frank on the panel. So I guess he thought that's who I was. And that was fine with me. Great time was had by all. Ken sang his Oogie Boogie song. I talked about my memories of being up there at Skellington Studios in San Francisco for a memorable few days when I was writing the book and interviewing all these great animators. And, of course, I went on to interview Henry Selick, the director, and Tim Burton, and Danny Elfman, and Caroline Thompson, who wrote the script, and Denise DeNovi, one of the producers, and all these people. And it was a really fascinating project to be on, and one that's sort of stuck in my life for the last 20 years. The Nightmare Before Christmas has always meant a great deal to me. Because there have been so many celebratory events about it, it's kept The Nightmare Before Christmas alive in my life for these two decades, and I'm really grateful for that. It's been a lot of fun, and we've had some great adventures. I've met some great people, including our friend Glenn Shaddix, who was the voice of the mayor. And he passed away a few years ago, and he is missed. And I thought it would be rather fun when I finally saw the slide with my name on it that was projected behind me. I didn't notice it at the time, of course, because I wasn't looking behind me. I was just looking at Ken Page, and I was looking out at 1,000 clapping people, which is a very pleasant feeling. So I didn't see the slide, but illustrating the slide is the mayor, who was the two-faced mayor that Glenn played. And he always told great stories about how he got that part and how he developed the character, and we miss him. And we were last there when the film was converted to 3D, and there was a huge premiere party right across the street, and everybody was there. And even all the voice people, Paul Rubens and all these other people, and my wife and I sat for a few interesting minutes at a table with Marilyn Manson, who turned out to be a swell guy, a very nice guy. Not that I ever had any reason to think that he wouldn't be, but he was very nice, and we enjoyed our brief time with him and got to talk with everybody else. So it's been fun, and this last week when we did it last Tuesday night, as I record this, was just another great fun moment in a fun two decades. I wonder if they'll do it again next year. I hope they do another one, because next year, of course, Nightmare Before Christmas will be able to drink and vote. So that'll be a great evening, I would think. My guest tonight is Donna Hill. Donna is a friend of mine for a few years back, and she put out a terrific kind of coffee table book, heavily illustrated book on Rudolph Valentino, which I highly recommend, and I will put a link to it on her page. It's not available from Amazon, so I can't do what I normally do and put an Amazon link, but there is a place you can go to buy it. So Donna knows a lot about Valentino, and it's fun talking about him. She's also working on a book on Dorothy Gish, and I think Dorothy is long overdue for some more recognition, so I wanted to talk to Donna a little bit about that. This interview took place last July when I was in San Francisco for the San Francisco Silent Film Festival. I meant to interview several people at the Castro Theater. As it turns out, I only interviewed one, David Shepard. And all the other people I interviewed while I was up there, I interviewed at various points around town. As it turns out, my wife and I were staying at a wonderful bed and breakfast on Haight Street called The Parsonage. And let me recommend that to you if you're ever in San Francisco, because it was really wonderful. Because there was a slight mix-up, my fault, on the reservations, we ended up in a basement room, basically. But it was a huge place with a kitchen and a bath. I mean, it was like a suite. And so that's where we elected to have Donna come visit and do the interview there. There's a slightly cavernous quality to the sound, but nevertheless, it was great fun, and I think it was a fascinating conversation. So let's go now to my talk with Donna Hill, and I'll see you on the other side. You didn't spring from the womb liking Rudolph Valentino, so how did that start for you?
No, but I sprung from the womb loving films.
Oh, good.
And I was a movie buff at, you know, a very early age, when you could still watch your local television, you know, when you had your four stations and then UHF stations. And they would show old movies at like 7 o'clock at night, and then they would repeat them at midnight. So I, you know, got my start with old Warner Brothers films and Fox films and stuff like that. And then PBS was showing the Silence series.
Yeah, The Silent Years.
The Silent Years. And those were some of my first exposure to silent films. And I think about a year or two before those were running, I had seen Blood and Sand on our local PBS station. And I was like, wow, who is that? I want to know more about this person. And this was, of course, pre-VHS, dinosaur age, and pre-DVD, so it was very difficult to get to see these films.
So were you a teenager or a child?
I was early teens.
Okay.
So, you know, I spent a lot of time staying up later than I should have, watching movies.
Didn't we all?
Yes, you know, frantically marking the TV guide, I want to see that one, and I want to see that one. And every once in a while, I'd get lucky and there'd be a silent film. But most of those occurred, of course, on PBS.
Yeah.
And then I would go to the library, and this was what I almost call the golden age of film books, which was the 1970s, when you had The Parade's Gone By, which was revelatory to me.
Sure.
And I think everybody else that we know. And from there, it just blossomed. I read everyone's autobiography that I could find, including, you know, any books I could find about Valentino, which would be the most prevalent or most common one was the 1967 bio done by Irving Shulman. And then when I came of age and was able to drive, I discovered the wonderful thing called an antique collector's fair and started acquiring movie memorabilia. And my first fair that I went to, I scored a beautiful score. 3 vintage 11x14 portraits of Valentino.
Wow.
For $15 each. Ah, the good old days. And from then, you know, I was just watching more films and collecting more, and that's how it started.
Wow.
And this, of course, it wasn't solely and exclusively Valentino. I was watching everybody's silent films that I could get my hands on.
Sure. Was there anybody else that you were particularly drawn to in those days?
I liked Lillian Gish a lot, Mary Pickford, Clara Bow. I wanted to see more of Richard Arlen, but there wasn't a lot available. I did finally see Beggars of Life. At that time, when I was driving and there were more theaters, I used to go to a revival theater in Saratoga, which was called the Vitaphone. And I don't remember exactly when it was built, but it was on the outside it looked like a Quonset hut. It had the best acoustics of any theater I've ever been into. The guy that ran it was a complete movie fanatic. And he would go down to the proscenium, and he could whisper, and you could hear exactly what he was saying at the very back row. I mean, the acoustics in there were great. You could hear people talking in the front row. That got annoying. But that's where I first saw Adventures of Robin Hood for the first time. He had a brand new IB print from Warner Brothers.
Wow.
I'd never seen Technicolor on the big screen before.
Yeah, that's a life changer, isn't it?
And I sat there for the first 10 minutes just going, and this was a film I knew well. It was a favorite film that ran on, you know, cable, well, not cable, but local television all the time. And to see that for the first time was just like, oh my God, I've never seen this before.
Yeah.
And so that opened up a whole new world. And seeing silence on the big screen at that point were hard. But there was also a small theater here in San Francisco called The Avenue. And they had silent films on Friday nights. So I would drive up from Sunnyvale and meet friends here in the city and go to The Avenue. And see, that's where I finally saw Beggars of Life for the first time. And they had live organ with Bob Vaughn. And it was great. It was wonderful. Great experience. I loved it.
Yeah, it's really different. When I grew up in a real small town and had no access to any of that, and even the TV channels we got didn't show old movies much. But when I got to Boston to go to college, that's when there were theaters everywhere. There were revival theaters all over town. So it really became, as soon as I was sitting in a theater and seeing something that I had already seen before, like a Marx Brothers film or a W.C. Fields film or something, realizing exactly how different the experience was. But I also have an experience like yours with The Adventures of Robin Hood, because the first time I ever saw it in a Technicolor 35mm print, it was like, I have never seen this before.
Yeah, and it has only been duplicated now, seeing the Blu-ray.
Yeah.
The restoration on the Blu-ray is just like, that's how I remember seeing it in the theater.
Yeah, it's stunning.
It's stunning. It's a phenomenal film anyway. I mean, pure popcorn movie, but entertaining and beautiful to look at. And the detail and the costuming and the sets that come out and the cinematography, fantastic.
I sometimes think that Minute for Minute is possibly the single most entertaining movie ever made. It's just
even
pure
over
fun.
Beau Gist?
That's a different thing. That's a different no, it's just great fun and just eye candy, and it's just beautiful.
Yeah, Warner Brothers is my favorite studio by far for their product that came out. I mean, many of my favorite films are Warner Brothers pictures.
Sure.
Even the not-so-great pictures, there's just something about a Warner Brothers film that I just love. And I love MGM and Fox films, too. I think MGM is a little bit too stodgy and too polished, but I identify with the grittiness and the snappy dialogue of a good Warner Brothers picture.
Yeah, I've always said, you set me down with any random Warner Brothers film from 1933, and I will be happy. I don't care what it is, because by and large, it's going to have enough stuff in there that I'm going to like.
Yeah, and character people that I adore.
Yeah, yeah. I could just watch them all the time, and of course, when you're watching Warner Brothers from the 30s, you're seeing them all the time.
Right. So
they become as important as any. Alan Jenkins, you know.
Aileen McMahon.
Sure, they're as big as anybody. So, so when did you make the change from becoming somebody who loved movies to somebody who really wanted to research them and look into the, was it just a gradual change?
Well, I'd say, God, it must have been around 1980 or so. A very dear friend of mine said, you know, one of the things that I'd really love to see one of these days, this was a friend who also liked Valentino a lot, he really needs to have a coffee table book, you know, and one that just shows him as he was. And part of my journey in discovering Valentino is based on one photograph, and it's from the book Everyone Hates, Hollywood Babylon. But there's a wonderful picture that Ken Enger used of Valentino and his secretary, Margaret Neff, on the set of Blood and Sand to open the chapter. And at that point, Valentino's reputation was pretty crappy. You know, he's a lounge lizard, wasn't smart, was sort of, you know, not worth talking about. His reputation was more than he actually was as a person. And I looked at that photo, and here was a young man, you know, he's in his 20s, but he's serious. He's, you know, looking over correspondence. He's got a secretary. I mean, he's not, you know, flopping around. Granted, he's in costume for the film. But I looked at that, and I was, who is that? That's who I want to find out who that is. And that started the journey. And then that coincided with collecting. And I've always liked the photographs more than anything, although I do have a couple of posters, and I love my posters. But I do like the candid photographs, the behind-the-scenes photos or the private photos. And after 30 years of collecting and getting to know other collectors, there was enough material to finally do a book. And I thought it was time.
So you compiled the book of mostly photos to make the coffee table book that you had long dreamed of. What kind of research did you do into Valentino himself?
Well, I have almost every book published about him in many languages. I'm missing only a couple of really obscure titles. And I also started researching in, you know, newspaper, magazines of the day, private correspondence where I could find it, which was very hard to find. But I did come upon a couple of caches of very important paperwork that nobody had used before. And just, you know, kept digging away and acquired crates and crates of paper and microfilm print-offs. And ultimately, I had more material than I could use in the book because I decided when I went to self-publish, after trying to get a contract for quite a while, and finally losing the last university one when my editor, we were, you know, this close to maybe inking a deal, and she moved to another publisher.
Oh.
And it was like, that was 3 years. And yeah. I was like, I don't want to do this. I really want to get this off my desk now.
Yeah.
So that's when I started the serious work. And the manuscript, when I went with Blurb, it gave me what I really wanted, which was 100% control of the content, 100% of the design. And so, unfortunately, that came with a price. But in the end, I erred in favor of reducing the manuscript text portion in favor of the photographs because I had an abundance of riches that I never imagined I would have.
Yeah.
Because collectors were tremendously generous. They gave me carte blanche to use whatever I wanted from their collection, which was wonderful. And then it got down to the point of, okay, how do I choose? And I sort of mentally decided the book was going to be 200 pages. This was based on the cost of the publishing. And I managed to cram 400 photos in that.
Wow.
And that was pretty good.
Absolutely. Did you have mostly 8x10 photos to begin with, or did you have a lot of scans and JPEGs and so forth?
About 80% of the book is from my own collection. I got scans from friends, and other people actually sent me photographs to scan myself, there were a couple of people that did it. We'd never met. We only knew each other by email.
Hmm.
And they sent me originals to scan, which was amazing.
Yeah.
Because even my collector friends wouldn't do that. they'd let me come over to their place and scan them.
Sure.
And I totally understand that. I'm certainly not going to send my stuff out willingly for somebody to scan. But I mostly had 8x10s. There were some, you know, candid photographs. They were snapshots. So those were vintage originals, and they're like, you know, 1 or 2 inches big.
Yeah.
So I was scanning those at, you know, 600 DPI, you know, up as large as I could get them so I could then, you know, clean them up a little bit and make them large enough so they were usable.
Yeah. Did you do the layout of the book yourself?
I did. The publisher I used, Blurb, has their own software called Booksmart, which is an oxymoron in some ways. And when I started working with them that was about 2009, I think I started actually inputting stuff into the book. The software went through several iterations, and now it's, you know, 3 years on after pushing the publish button, it's changed a lot, and there's more options for design and layout than there were initially. But I haven't wanted to go back to do it to prettify it even more.
Sure.
Because for me, it always was, the photographs are telling the story. I really don't want the distraction of lots of curlicues and other page design. I mean, there's a couple of widgets in there, but,
yeah,
you know, just enough to make it look, okay, that's nice. It's a nice touch.
Well, it's a beautiful book.
Thank you.
And so I'm now telling all the listeners, all six of them, to get this book. So look for a big spike in sales when...
That would be lovely.
Two more copies are sold over the next year.
That'd be fine. I mean, for a book that has no distribution through, you know, a professional network, I mean, I do have an ISBN, so it is listed in Books and Print. But because of the expense of publishing it and it's print on demand, there isn't a way to get it on Amazon where it's a reasonable price beyond, you know, what it's priced.
Yeah.
And unfortunately with Blurb, since I initially published it, they have changed their pricing structure for books, and the price has gone up 4 times.
Wow.
So, commiserately, their price has gone up, my commission has gone down to pretty much zero.
Mm.
And I'm hoping to be able to republish it with someone else. I've got a friend who's going to help me work toward that end, which would be nice. I'm hoping that would, one, lower the price of the book, and two, open the channels of distribution so it would get a wider audience.
Yeah.
That said, I have no complaints. I initially thought this is such a niche book, and the golden age of the coffee table books is really essentially over.
Yeah.
And I thought if I sold 100 copies, I would be thrilled. And I passed that within 2 months of publishing it. And it's, you know, sold well over 500 copies. I think we're close to about 550, which I think is respectable for what it is. It's an expensive book.
Sure.
And people seem to want it, and I'm very happy. I mean, I have a Facebook page for it. I promote it on my website, and that's pretty much it. And then the rest of it's word of mouth.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was done as a labor of love because I felt Valentino deserved to have a little bit of a nod for not so much a biography like Emily Leiter's excellent book, but something that people could look at and see, okay, this is who this person was.
Yeah. Well, I'm only sorry that you haven't become fabulously wealthy on your book like I have. So,
I don't even think Kevin Brownlow's become fabulously wealthy on his books, and he certainly deserves to be
as
well.
No, I don't think he has. And if anybody deserves to be fabulously wealthy, it's Kevin Brownlow.
Well, at least he has an Oscar now.
Well, that is good. So, let's talk a little bit about Valentino, because I think still he's looked at as a little bit more image than substance. I mean, I think there's still a general perception of him as an icon. Certainly, his beautiful face and he photographs like no other human ever was. And yet, I still think people don't really think that much of him.
And
I think he's still underrated, I guess.
And I think a good part of that has a lot to do with this was a complaint for me for many years. Whenever a new book came out, you know, I would always pick it up and read it, purchase it, and they would use the same 15 or 20 photographs. And invariably, they're the pop-eyed, you know, glaring, sneering, scowling photographs from The Sheik, which, you know, is not my favorite film. But I've grown to have a soft spot for it. I mean, because as I watched more Valentino films, I realized he was much more the product also, not only of the scenario, but of the director he was working with. And, you know, George Melford directed The Sheik. Not a great director, very pedestrian.
Mm-hmm.
And The Sheik is very much over the top because it was a scandalous book, and, you know, this is what Paramount was going for, although it's very neutered compared to the book.
Sure.
But then if you look at his next film, which is also directed by Melford, which is Miranda the Lady Letty, it is a sleeper. Valentino's great in this movie, and his performance is completely different. I think if people had more of an opportunity to see films like The Four Horsemen, The Eagle, or The Son of the Sheik, they would see Valentino at his best. I mean, when you think about Four Horsemen, where he's directed by Rex Ingram, He was very early in his career. It was his truly his breakout film.
Yeah.
And he gives a performance that still stands the test of time, I think. I think it's his best film. It's my favorite of his films.
I agree.
And you realize when you see the scope of his career, which was very short, it was only 5 years at the top, he came in with that talent. He did need help nurturing it. But given the opportunity, he ran with it, and he was much better than he's been given credit for. And in my own little way, I hope, you know, my book and my website have helped let people look at him differently and see, you know, he wasn't just some guy in a flamboyant costume, you know, flaring his nostrils and, you know, kissing up a girl's arm, although that is very effective in Son of the Sheik.
Well, certainly it is.
It's one of the most romantic silent films of the era.
Yeah.
You know, for the exotic kind of, you know, fun popcorn movies.
But I find I've seen most of his extant work, but I've had to seek it out. And luckily, living in Los Angeles, there are lots of venues where they show 35mm prints of silent films. And so little by little, I've been able to see good presentations of at least the top films mm-hmm. that I know of. But it still seems like he's not front and center like so many other silent film people are. I mean, I think if you had an interest in Douglas Fairbanks, you would have much more opportunity just to see his work.
Well, Doug made more and better films.
Yeah.
Doug was his own producer. Valentino came late into producing. He came to United Artists in 1925, and he'd only completed two films for United Artists before he died. Let's face it, Paramount, as wonderful as Paramount could be, they ground out programmers. And that was part of Valentino's complaint when he went on strike in 1923, because he wanted to do better pictures. And he saw the pictures that Fairbanks and Pickford were making, and Paramount wasn't willing to do that.
Yeah, Paramount was, I mean, they would do a big specialty film once or twice a year.
Like The Ten Commandments
yeah.
in 1923. I mean, Blood and Sand is a good film. I don't think, again, it's his best performance. I think it errs on the side of overacting and mugging, although Nita Naldi, on the other hand, she mugs a bit, but it works for the character, and I think she steals the movie from him.
Yeah.
I mean, and the character in that film is also a little bit weak and thankless as well. But I think part of the problem with Valentino, some of his films haven't dated very well, and they're also not terribly good. As great a build-up as we had for Beyond the Rocks,
yeah.
It's kind of a dud, even with Swanson and Valentino in it. There's just not that much good in it. I don't know if the American print was any better than, you know, the Dutch print that was found.
Yeah.
We'll never know, unless it turns up somewhere.
Yeah, no matter how good somebody is, if the movie itself is not particularly good, the actor is not going to come off all that well.
No.
It's just,
and I think, you know, Valentino was typed over time as, you know, the Latin Lover, and while I think his last two films are really, really good, he didn't really get another opportunity to shine like he did in Four Horsemen.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Metro films that he did that survive, they're pretty good. The Camille is okay. I mean, it's a little bit weird. I mean, I like it because the sets are very cool.
Sure.
Designed neat. And, you know, Nazimova is unique, but a good part of his part on screen was cut because she recognized how well he was doing and was like, okay, I'm the star of this film. So, you know, I think it's a sad balance of, we're very fortunate that so many of his films do survive. I mean, only two of his major films are truly lost. A Saint and Devil, which I'm sure is not good, but I'm dying to see it. And only about 5 seconds of it exists that I know about.
Mm.
And then Uncharted Seas, which was a film he did for Metro before moving to Paramount, and not a great story, but I still want to see it.
Well, yeah, I've always been struck because I've on more than one occasion seen a double bill of The Sheik and Son of the Sheik, and Son of the Sheik is so much better in almost every way that it's, and he's so much better in it because he's not playing it too big or not mugging that much.
No, I think a lot of that has to do with, one, he was working with George Fitzmaurice.
Yeah.
He was producer on the film, even though it's John Considine. I mean, it's Valentino's film as well. You know, it's got the quality sets that he wanted. You know, they're done by Cedric Gibbons. Oh, no, I'm sorry. No, William Cameron Menzies.
Mm.
And, you know, he had more control over it, and it was the type of quality production that he wanted to do. You know, it was unequal with a Pickford or Fairbanks kind of picture.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's tongue-in-cheek. He knew at this point in his life that he was not so much long in the tooth, but he knew that he wasn't going to be playing these roles forever. And his ultimate goal, in reality, was to go behind the camera because he loved mechanical things. I mean, one of his hobbies was photography.
Mm-hmm.
He bought very expensive debris cameras and debris movie cameras and anybody's good camera equipment, and he was constantly taking home movies, and he took pictures on the set and shot, you know, home movies on the set.
Do you have a lot of those pictures?
I have a few. The family actually has some, because he kept some, and then some after he died. We don't know how they got dispersed, but, you know, I actually managed to get a couple, which was nice, and then the Valentino family was very generous. They allowed me to use a couple of photos from the family archive for book.
So you were able to contact them. That's
mm-hmm.
nice.
And of course, I'm greedy. I wish I'd been able to use more, but, you know.
Well,
I got to use two, so that's more than anybody else got to use.
Well, that's great. And Valentino had the same sort of trouble during his own lifetime. I mean, there was he was not particularly well respected by a lot of the. I know that a lot of men in the audience thought that he was very effeminate and. You know, he had the pink powder puff thing going on. And so he had a bit of a struggle for acceptance or authenticity even during his own lifetime.
There right? there was a level of, or a lack of respect. Although early on, I think the audience members were pretty equally divided, men and women. I mean, you look at crowds, particularly the newsreel footage that went to see him during the Minerva tour, the little bit of footage that exists, there's just as many men there as women. And I realized, yes, that was seeing him in person. But I think it was also the choice of roles. In particular, when he came back after his strike, he had the option of choosing between Monsieur Beaucaire, which was the film that they made, and Captain Blood.
Mm.
And I think Captain Blood would have probably been a better choice,
yeah.
More of a swashbuckler. I think if you want to compare him to, say, Errol Flynn, same kind of thing. Although guys liked Flynn, it's, you know, I think Rudy was just thought of as being a little too slick, and I think by and large a lot of guys were jealous because
yeah.
he had this magnetism. I mean, you can see it leap off the screen.
Sure.
I mean, there was definitely a personality there, and it affected women very strongly and still does, I can attest. I mean, that there are still rabid arguments that go on about, you know, his films and his performances to this day.
Well, I know many women now, I mean, living actual humans at the moment, who the first time they saw the tango start in Four Horsemen just went, you know, floated above the chair.
Oh, yeah, especially if you're fortunate enough, as we have been, to see the Brownlow restoration.
Yeah.
That tango sequence is, you know, it's sex on video right
yeah,
there.
It's really. And even as a heterosexual male, it's very plain to me what the appeal is for
yeah.
him. And also his performance in that film is really good anyway. I mean,
I think it for a he was, what, 24 years old? 23? When they were shooting it? No, he was 24. Very mature.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I credit that. I don't mean to diss Valentino, but he also, in addition to his own natural talent, he got tremendous support from Gene Mathis, who was his mentor, and also from Ingram at that time. And, you know, I can't speak highly enough for Rex Ingram. I respect him a great deal
sure.
as a director. I think he was a phenomenal filmmaker and doesn't today get the respect that he really deserves.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen any Rex Ingram film that wasn't pretty terrific. Although his last film is not all that great, but I do love it because it's a Foreign Legion film, Beirut.
That I have not seen.
I think Valentino is a great example of the kind of nurturing that any artist needs, and that he didn't always get what he should have gotten in terms of guidance from the filmmakers, and then his career ended at such a young age that we never really saw him fully blossom into what he might have been.
He was beginning to fully blossom in 25 and 26. But I think also there's no getting around the fact that he was a very bad businessman. I mean, he was hot-headed in some ways, immature. He was a spoiled middle child growing up. He wasn't the sedate, somber thinker as his older brother was. He was much more, you know, spur of the moment and impulsive. And he didn't always listen to the right advice. And he sometimes gave too much of his power away. I mean, there's no denying that he loved his second wife, Natasha Rembova. Did he give her a little too much power or too much sway in his business-making decisions? He may have. But he also had his business manager at the time, after the Mineralava tour, George Ullman, who had no experience in film and really had no experience being a business manager for a film star either, but they managed to make it work and at least be profitable for a while. But, you know, Valentino made poor decisions, and he also, because he was under contract to Paramount, I think while initially it was great that he did The Sheik, it also made him a studio employee. And would it have been any better if he'd stayed at Metro? Hard to say, because June Mathis went with him to Paramount, at least temporarily, and then she went to Goldwyn. Would he have gone to Goldwyn with her? And then, you know, when Goldwyn went belly up, would he have gone to MGM and ultimately worked with Garbo?
Yeah.
You know, people like that. Hard to say.
Well, I'm interested in Son of the Sheik because I'm curious as to whose idea it was. Was it something that the studio foisted on him and then he was just able to make it better? Or was it something that he thought would be a good way to repeat his success?
I don't know. His producer at the time in charge of his production was John Considine, mm-hmm. Tim Considine's father.
Sure.
And I expect it was discussed, and he really didn't want to do it, but I think he wanted to do it right. And he recognized that, you know, his last couple of movies didn't do so well. When he left Paramount, he went temporarily with J.D. Williams at Ritz-Carlton, which is a bad marriage all the way around. And, you know, his Cobra flopped. Although, looking at it now, 80 years later, Cobra's not that bad of a film.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not bad. But it wasn't what the fans were looking for in 1925. The move to UA was good. The Eagle was fun. And going back to The Sheik was a smart business move. And they did it right. They adapted the book. They took the two sons and merged them into one. He got to play the dual role of the father, which he loved.
Mm-hmm.
He when he got into costume and, you know, got the goatee and mustache and beard much like you,
sure.
He walked around on the
set.
We
do look a lot alike, I find, sure.
Yes, you do. There is a great resemblance. he loved walking around on the back lot, and people didn't recognize him.
Wow.
He thought that was the best thing. He loved it. And he liked doing the two different characters, the younger, impetuous son, and the older, little bit wiser, but still hot-headed father. So he really enjoyed doing that. And he brought his friend Agnes Ayers, who worked in The Sheik with him, as a special favor. He was also very good friends with her husband of the time, Manuel Realche.
Mm-hmm.
And they were good friends back to at least 1919. I'm not sure how they met, but in my book there's a photo from now in the Academy collection that is inscribed to Realche, and it's inscribed in 1919, so I knew their friendship dated at least as far back as that. So I think ultimately, you know, Son of the Sheik was a smart business move, and he was planning to follow it up with a biographical film, of Cellini.
Hmm.
And I'm not sure if it was going to be based on the Sabatini book or not, I can't remember. But it was going to be a big costume deal. And I think that was probably going to be one of his last costume things. And then, you know, who knows what would have happened, because by that time, sound would have come in.
Sure.
And I always get asked, do you think he would have made it in sound? And as you know, I'm sure, that Valentino made two recordings,
mm-hmm.
singing, in 1923, just before the electrical process came in. And the story goes that after he made these recordings, these were done at the Brunswick Studios in Camden. He heard, you know, they played back the wax disc or whatever, and he just said, there goes my opera career.
Ah.
And he gave a few copies away. They'd pressed some as friends, and then they sat languishing until after he passed away, and then they got issued in the 1930s. It's hard to say if he would have made it. I think he probably could have, but by the time sound came in, his type, the romantic foreign type, spent a good part of the period in the early 30s as being more of a buffoonish character.
Sure.
That he would have had to have either gone behind the camera or completely changed, because the Continental didn't come back into fashion until the mid to late 30s.
Yeah.
You know, by the time they were making films like Midnight in 1939.
And even then, those Continental types tended to be a little sleazier. Or
yeah.
The villains, you wanted a real all-American.
Or comic relief, like Eric Rhodes in either The Gay Divorcee or Top Hat.
Sure.
Your wife, she is safe with Tonetti. He prefers spaghetti. I just can't see him doing that. But I've always said I would have loved to have seen him play Dracula. I think he would have been great. As much as I love Lugosi.
Do you have any idea of how well he spoke English?
I've heard conflicting stories. And going back to his recordings, he recorded the Kashmiri song in English. The accent is very thick. The second song he recorded was in Spanish. And he spoke Spanish, French, Italian, English, and apparently knew a little bit of German, but was fluent in those four languages. You can hear his accent, but I've heard people like Lois Wilson, Doris Kenyon, B.B. Daniels all said that, you know, he spoke very good English. He did have an accent. Other people said he had a very thick accent. I think it was probably somewhere in between.
Yeah. So his career could well have been kiboshed by that.
I think it probably would have been, ultimately. He would have probably, especially if he'd been put into, you know, pictures like the early, you know, legendary John Gilbert, you know, I love you, I love you, I love you kind of things, with the bad dialogue, the stagey dialogue, I think it just would have stymied him.
Yeah, it's too bad. I mean, it's really interesting to look at that period and see what people did right and see what they did wrong and see who just had an instinct for it. Because Ronald Colman, for instance, immediately went to a kind of lighthearted, very casual sort of mystery comedy movie that wasn't anything like all the Latin lovers that he'd been playing in the silent film. And I think he instinctively knew you don't want to go in too heavy. You want to be a bit more lighthearted.
Are you talking about Raffles?
Yeah. And then other people like John Gilbert, you know, they always said that it was because of his voice, but it wasn't. It was just because he tried to carry an image that suddenly audiences didn't buy anymore.
Yeah, and I think it was also, I think there is some truth to the, you know, his battles with Louis B. Mayer and MGM, and, you know, the quality of the material they gave him wasn't good, and he had a big fat contract, and they wanted to get rid of him.
Yeah.
Much like what Warner Brothers did to Kay Francis.
Yeah. And some people were able to ride it out. I mean, Garbo is the perfect example of.
But again, with Garbo, they waited until almost 1930 before they put her in talkie.
Yeah. They were worried about it, because her accent was really thick. And they just figured out a way to...
Well, the technology, I think, by the time 1930 rolled around, had improved so much that, you know, Garbo's voice was, you know, deep, throaty, and that worked.
Yeah.
Whereas in 1927, it may not have.
But even that, putting her in Anna Christie was a great thing, because it was against type in a way. She was not a sultry temptress. She was this very low-class character. And so it was... It was enough against type that people accepted it. So that's a fascinating period to me.
And, yeah, me too. And Alexander Walker's book on it, The Shattered Silence, a great book to read about that period. But case in point, same film, Anna Christie, another performer we saw this weekend who made the transition, which is Marie Dressler, who we saw in The Patsy this weekend, who was marvelous in silent film.
Yeah.
Totally made the transition to sound and was phenomenal in both.
Yeah, there were those. I mean, the the list goes on about people who were just lucky in a way. It's because it's more than skill. There were many great actors who just mm-hmm. couldn't make because of their voice or mm-hmm. whatever. But you do always have other people like Laurel and Hardy, for instance, whose voices turned out to be exactly what audiences thought they would be. So all that stuff is great. But it's still always disconcerting to me to see a Ronald Colman film from the 20s because he so often plays
an
Italians. Or, you know, and you think, well, no. I know what his voice sounds like.
You can hear his voice. Would you still love me if I weren't king?
Yes.
And it just doesn't match the
Maisie.
Film.
Maisie, the powder stings.
But I do wish that, again, more of his silent films existed. I mean, he had that great partnership with Vilma Bankey, who made Valentino's last two films, who was marvelous.
Yeah.
Another victim of the sound era, thick Hungarian accent.
Very much so.
But she and Valentino had a very special chemistry, I think. I think they were good friends off screen. And even though the language communication was difficult, you know, on screen it translated into, you know, firecrackers. It was spectacular to see the two of them in both films.
So Valentino didn't even live to see Son of the Sheik released, did he?
Not the full release. He was starting a press junket, and they had the premiere at the Million Dollar Theater in L.A., where he did see it there.
Oh, okay.
There's photographs. You can see him in the audience. And I'm assuming that after that he came up here. He stayed at the Fairmont for his last visit here. He actually stayed there fairly often. Especially when you know the geography of the city a little bit, his in-laws at the time, the Hudnuts, Richard Hudnut and Natasha's mother, bought an apartment up on Nob Hill. And it is literally across the street from the Fairmont.
Wow.
So when he and she were having their first marriage difficulties after he was arrested for bigamy, he stayed at the Fairmont, and it's literally a 2-minute walk to the Hudnut apartment, which is where Natasha would stay. So that sort of makes sense. But I digress. His last trip here was mid-June. He was good friends with the chief of police and the mayor, Rolf. And I don't remember. I'm pretty sure they may have screened the film, but I can't remember for sure off the top of my head. But he did host a press party at the hotel, and then traveled on east. And as we know, you know, in Chicago he had the horrible press trouble with whoever the author was who wrote the Pink Powder Puff article, and
mm-hmm.
that just enraged him. But also he was ill at the time.
Yeah.
And you can see it in Son of the Sheik. There are sections of the film because it was finished in, you know, early 1926. And you know, it was got out fairly quickly, but you can see in sections of the film where he doesn't look well, and it's not just, you know, the makeup, or the makeup is the old Sheik. It's even when he's the young Sheik, he doesn't look well. There's sections where he looks kind of tired.
Yeah.
And so by the time he gets to Chicago in July, it's, you know, horrible heat wave. He's still stressing over his divorce from Natasha. And he's doing the press thing, and then he gets hit in Chicago with this nasty article. And he's a proud man. And it's difficult to have these kind of, you know, things flung at you. And it was scurrilous, and it hurt his manhood and his virility and, you know, his self-respect. And it made him a figure of fun. And it enraged him.
Yeah.
And I think that also exacerbated his illness. I mean, he had ulcers. He was, according to his manager and other, I mean, he was drinking bicarb, you know, by the gallon. And he hadn't been treated for them because he wouldn't go to the doctor. And in all other respects in his life, he was very healthy. I mean, his only real vice was that he chain smoked like crazy, but he tried to take good care of himself, physically otherwise. And I think the combination of that, the heat wave that the country was going through, you know, pre-air conditioning days, you know, and burning the candle at both ends, unfortunately, you know, the ulcers, and it just happened at a bad time. And, of course, medicine being what it was in the 20s, there, you know, for what we could spend for a quarter today would have saved his life.
Yeah.
If he'd had a few shots of antibiotics. But like Houdini, a few months later, same thing, peritonitis.
Yeah.
And tragic, horrible, nasty, painful death. People really don't realize in how miserable it was. I mean, when I was doing research on his passing, and there's a French biography which was published in the late 70s, and a friend of mine translated the last chapters for me. And this woman had interviewed the doctors, and when you read about the agony that he was in, it's just horrifying. And, you know, anyone from that period who died of peritonitis, I mean, it was awful, painful, horrible.
Sure.
And people really, today, I mean, you don't have a concept of what this is. It, you know, similarly, if you think, equate it in today's mind, it's like, you know, having a terrible cancer, like, you know, bone cancer, where
yeah.
the pain is just unbelievable. So, you know, unfortunately, poor Rudy, tragic at 31, you know, a horrible, awful death. But like James Dean and Marilyn Monroe, he has never aged and has gone on to a kind of immortality.
Well, I hope he appreciates that.
I don't know.
Maybe we'll find out one of these days. Who knows?
I don't know.
But,
but I think, you know, if he were to come back, he would be impressed with the fans of today in a lot of respects, because they're looking at him more critically but less critically,
mm-hmm.
because the fans of today are able to discern the person on screen
sure.
and the person who made the film. And I think part of it, I think that's part of what he was going for. Although he was a private man, I mean, I can only imagine what it must have been like, because every train stop he took, wherever he went, photographers, you know, he couldn't walk down the street after he'd made Four Horsemen and Son, or the Sheik. He couldn't walk down Hollywood Boulevard without getting harassed.
Yeah.
You know, there are stories during the Mineralava tour, you know, girls trying to sneak into the train, sneak into the hotel, sneak into the dressing tent where, you know, depending on what the venue was, where they were trying to dance. I mean, he was harassed constantly. And I just, you know, I can't imagine what that must have been like.
No, it's incredibly flattering in a way, you would mm-hmm. think, but it's still maddening, because you just can't live a life mm-hmm. with any kind of freedom.
But, you know, he did have a good life in a lot of respects. I mean, he sought wealth. He got it. He sought fame. He got that. He did have good friends. I mean, the few friends that were interviewed after he died or during his lifetime, they said really what a fun person he was. You know, he enjoyed physical activity. He enjoyed his favorite place to vacation. One of the places he loved going most was Palm Springs, because he could go out there and ride horses in the desert and, you know, get dressed up as a cowboy, which he loved. Looks silly today, but he loved it. Very down-to-earth kind of guy. Loved to take his cars apart. Love to drive too fast.
Mm-hmm.
Love to spend money.
I'm with him on all these mm-hmm. things so far. So,
yeah.
Yeah. He and I would be birds of a feather, I would think.
You know, he had a lot of happiness. He had a lot of sadness in his life. Some of it, you know, created based on his own actions.
Sure.
But I think if he came back and saw that his legacy, I mean, as film fans, we're extremely lucky. I mean, so many of his films exist. We can truly judge his career, unlike so many other stars where you think, you know, you've got only a fragment,
yeah.
or you can see posters and lobby cards and stills, but you can't judge, you know, you can look at the reviews of their films and in Photoplay and Motion Picture and in the trades, but you really have no idea
yeah.
because there's just nothing. And so I try not to kvetch too much, because, you know, he's really only missing two major films. You know, the Young Raja exists at least, you know, in fragments. You can see sort of what it was like.
Yeah.
And it was a stinky movie, if you ask me. Others others will disagree, but it was a stinker, and he was right to go out on strike after making it, because it was pretty crappy.
Well, speaking of people who we have underrepresented, I think, on film, your next project is on Dorothy Gish.
Yes.
And we have far too little of Dorothy Gish, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, I would agree with you there. Dorothy, you know, I've always been a fan of Lillian. I think I told you the other night, I've written two fan letters in my life. First one was to Lillian Gish, and I was probably about 16 or 17 when I wrote her, and she wrote me back.
Mm, nice.
And she signed the little thing that I sent her, which was lovely. I still have it. I don't know what I did with the letter. I didn't keep the letter. or it got lost somewhere over the last 40 years. And the second fan letter was to Kevin Brownlow. So I got an answer from him, too. And unfortunately, I didn't discover Dorothy until later. And one of the first films I saw, and the only film I've actually seen of Dorothy in the theater, was at CineCon when they showed The Bright Shawl, which was a film that was produced at the time independently by Barthelmess and the Gish sisters when they formed Inspiration Pictures. Mm-hmm. And they shot it down in Cuba. And when I first saw it, I enjoyed it. I went more because it was early William Powell at the time, I have to confess. And he played the villain, and he was wonderful. And I thought Dorothy was more like Pola Negri than... I really didn't have a concept of who she was at the time. But as I've gone through exposing myself to silent films from the Griffith era and beyond, and reading, you know, material that either in Valentino research or just passing by. I mean, she did do a film with Valentino, and she was a huge star at the time. Her output just doesn't exist, and you read in the trades how popular she was, and she was, you know, everyone says she was a wonderful comedian. And then I've seen some of the biographs, and then one of her triangle films exist, which is called Gretchen the Greenhorn, which mm-hmm. is charming.
Yes.
And she's so different from her more well-known sister Lillian, because much more of Lillian exists, and Griffith favored Lillian. I think essentially Griffith didn't have the comedy gene.
No, not at all.
I don't really have the slapstick gene myself, so I can identify. But he didn't pay as much attention, and sort of Dorothy got shunted off to Elmer Clifton and the Franklin brothers, which I don't think was a bad thing.
No.
But unfortunately for us, you know, when Dorothy went to Paramount, she was making films under the Artcraft banner, which was Mary Pickford's film division of Paramount. She was hugely popular. She was making what are called, I guess by today's terms, flapper comedies.
Sure.
And none of them exist. I mean, that whole output, I think there's one that maybe has five reels, The Country Flapper, that exists. But anything from like 1917 up to 1922 of her comedies, there's nothing.
Yeah.
And I think that's a tragedy. But then I saw Nell Gwynn, which Dorothy was a pioneer in her own right.
Yeah.
She was one of the first stars to go make films abroad. And she went to Britain and made films with Herbert Wilcox. And one of them was Nell Gwynn. And she is a little hottie in that movie.
She is. She's delightful in it.
And she's delightful. And it just made me wonder more about her. And I, you know, and Lillian was always very effusive, always, throughout her life. Lillian always said a lot of the same things, but she always said Dorothy was the more talented of the two of us.
Yeah.
And I think part of that is a product of sisterly love, because Lillian, of course, survived. She was much more aesthetic, or she took better care of herself, and she took her career more seriously. I don't think Dorothy, she enjoyed it. I don't think she was as strict about her career as Lillian, although she did work equally hard. But when the talkies came in, I mean, Dorothy made one talkie in 1930, British film again, and she starred with Charles Laughton. It's a lost film. It's on the BFI's top 10 list to find it. And what she saw, she didn't like. And so she went back to the stage for the next 30 years and traveled in, you know, touring in the 40s, doing Life with Father. But she had a solid stage career for 30 years.
Yeah.
And then came back and made a few talkies, but she at that point she didn't like filmmaking anymore. And part of me was, she's always been in Lillian's shadow. It's like, they're both there. You can see them both in Orphans of the Storm, and they're both wonderful in it. But Dorothy has sort of disappeared from the consciousness of the silent film world because her films don't exist.
Yeah.
And she's like a footnote. Oh, that's Lillian Gish's sister. And everything that I've read about Dorothy is she was delightful. And she was very popular. I mean, she was offered a $1 million contract with Paramount, and she turned it down in 1917, which is just remarkable. I mean, that she elected to stay with Griffith's company out of loyalty rather than go to Paramount. And, of course, she said, well, what would I do with all that money?
Yeah, it's really sad because she would have been better served at Paramount, I think, and there would have been directors there who would have better understood what she had to offer.
I think, you know, if she'd gotten under the hands of, like, Herbert Brennan or William DeMille, I think she could have made some really great films.
Sure.
And, you know, although I don't think she was ill-served by either the Franklin brothers or Elmer Clifton.
No, but as you say, Griffith, for all of his greatness, and I'm not disputing his greatness, however, he has no sense of humor. And I can't think of more than a handful of moments in any of his films that are amusing. You know? So he didn't really... Lillian is kind of the same way. She's not really a comic type.
No, the tragedy is.
Yeah, and so they work together well, but it's... you know, even in An Unseen Enemy, which is their film debut in 1912, you can see how lively and beautiful Dorothy is, but you can also see that Griffith is not engaged in much character work with them. He doesn't much care about that. And he never understood how to depict young people anyway. He'd always had girls skipping about and
bird kissing, as we like to
bird
say.
Bird kissing, yes. A lot of bird kissing.
A lot of bird kissing.
Yeah.
Even poor Clarine Seymour was sort of, you know, who was wonderful, but also awash in a flapperish stereotype in Griffith films. And it's a pity that she died as young as she did, because I think had she been able to move out of the Griffith fold, she would have had a good little career as well.
So is your aim for the Dorothy Gish project to do similar thing that you did with Valentino, or are you planning on more of a biography?
I'm hoping to do a biography. Dorothy wasn't as meticulous a keeper as Lillian was.
Mm-hmm.
The Gish collection of papers, such as much as Dorothy's exist, are in the Billy Rose. Most of the collection is Lillian's, but I'm sure there's plenty of material in there that refers to Dorothy. But, I mean, case in point, Lillian has 10,000 letters in her collection.
Wow.
So I'm hoping that I have enough material to do a biography, and I'll have to factor in the films as well, although that's going to be very difficult because we're going to have to rely solely on contemporary reviews. I was able to, fortunately, interview someone who worked with Dorothy, one of the few remaining people who knew her when she was alive and was friends with her for over 20 years. So that was delightful to be able to talk to her about Dorothy and learn a little bit.
Well, she made her last film in the 60s, right?
Yeah, her last film was The Cardinal, which was directed by Otto Preminger.
At least the chances are good that you could find somebody who worked with her or you knew her then.
Yes, but unfortunately, everybody I've written to has died right at the time.
Oh.
Either the letter's gone out or after I've sent the letter.
Okay, never write to me. That's all I'm saying.
Yes. Happened with Anne Francis. Wrote her. 2 months later, she was dead. It was like sad.
Oh. Yeah.
But I did talk to Carlton Carpenter, though, who was also delightful. Didn't have a lot of information, but he said she was wonderful. So that was good enough for me.
I expect that everybody you find who knew her would just say that.
That seems to be the case. I mean, she seems to have been quite, in the terms of the teens and 20s, quite a hoyden. And that seems to be she was a person who enjoyed having a good time. She was fun.
Yeah.
And I think that in the few clips of film that you see from that period, there's a trailer for Clothes Make the Pirate, and it seems that she was also very good at broad comedy. I mean, if she's cast as Leon Errol's wife, you know, you only see a little snippet of her in the trailer, but it's there, and that seems to work. She seemed to have fun with that. And she was a very good dramatic actress as well. I mean, she's wonderful in Orphans of the Storm. And she's wonderful in the closing scenes of Nell Gwynn. She's very touching. So I'm hoping to do her a little bit of justice, because I just think that she hasn't had the exposure that she deserves, and people just forget that she was... Yes, Lillian was a great star, but so was Dorothy.
Yeah.
And unfortunately for us, we don't get a chance to see too much of it. But I'm hoping that this might dig something out. We might find something.
Well, it's a worthy project because I've always admired her and have always been frustrated by not being able to see more of her. Mm-hmm. And it would be great if more stuff showed up.
Yeah, it would be. I mean, she was in plenty of biographs, but unfortunately most of the time relegated to the background because Griffith just, you know, he got the two of them, but he focused on Lillian, and not that that's a bad thing, but, you know.
Yeah, he had his point of view, but yeah. we wish that he could have found something more to do with Dorothy at the time.
But I'm hoping that, you know, somewhere along the way as I'm researching this, and it's going to take a while, that we'll have the opportunity to see some more stuff. I mean, I know, you know, the Bright Shawl's at UCLA, and I do need to revisit that.
Sure.
You know, I've seen Romola in the terrible print that exists. It's not very good, but she's wonderful in that. Not a good part for Ronald Coleman, though.
No.
Good part for William Powell, though. He was very good as a villain in the 20s.
Yeah.
And then, of course, talkies with that wonderful urbane.
Yeah, he goes back to what we were talking about earlier, that when you see him in the silence, he is so different than what he would become. And, of course, he became this iconic, witty...
Nick Charles, witty.
Yeah, but he's always playing villains, and there's just something about his face in the silent days that they thought, oh, this is a bad guy.
Yeah.
And, of course, you always think, no, it's William Powell. He's thinking witty thoughts even as he's doing these
bad
things.
And he is in the silent Beau Jest, right?
Yeah, yeah, as a bad guy. And a Weasley bad guy, too. A real
he's good at that.
Yeah. So, well, good luck on the Gish project, and it's really a worthy project.
Thank you.
And I'm behind it 100%. I only wish there was something I had that would help you, but I got nothing on her.
Yeah, unfortunately, she didn't work with Wild Bill Wallman.
No, never did. Never did.
didn't make a desert picture that I can remember.
Yeah. What was she thinking? I don't know.
I don't know.
She just had no foresight, I guess. No. That's what. But anyway, Donna, thank you so much.
Thank you,
Frank.
It's
been so much fun.
Thank you for having me. It's been an honor to make an appearance on your podcast.
Well, we'll do it again one of these days when the Dorothy Gish book comes out.
I'll hold you to that.
Okay.
Thanks, Frank.
That was a fun talk with Donna, and I'll talk to her again when the Dorothy Gish project is finished. And I look forward to that. As I said in my conversation with her, I'm a big admirer of Dorothy Gish, and I was able to meet Lillian Gish on a couple of occasions, but never met Dorothy, sad to say. But I always admired her, and there's far too little of her work that exists, at least as far as we know. So let's keep our fingers crossed that more films turn up, because I have a feeling that anything that does is going to be terrific. I want to remind you once again, as I always do, and which nobody does, I wish you would all go to iTunes and leave a nice review and a 5-star rating. I've had 48 people do that, and I love those 48 people, but I would like to be getting 48 reviews a week, not over the course of more than a year. And it would really help, because I'm struggling to get an audience here, and I would very much appreciate anything that you could do to help push that along. And that all just involves telling your friends about it and sharing it on social media. There's a Facebook page for the Commentary Track. I also have a personal Facebook page, and I'm on Twitter, FrankThompson10. I think I'm supposed to say @FrankThompson10. I've got a Tumblr account. I'm trying to hit all the bases that I can. But most of all, I'm just trying to turn out a really good podcast every week, or every 2 weeks sometimes. It's a little sporadic because life is very busy. But I've got some more good ones coming up. In fact, I just interviewed Leonard Maltin today, and I think that'll be up next week or maybe the week after that. And so the Commentary Track has featured interviews with at least the first rank of American film historians, and, of course, the great Kevin Brownlow. But I've also had Rudy Belmer and Tony Slide and David Shepard and so many others, and really fascinating, interesting people who talk in much more depth here than you will hear on the radio or almost any other place, because there's really no other podcast that's doing this kind of talk about film, and especially about classic film and silent film. So please spread the word if you can. I don't expect this to ever turn into the Adam Carolla show with 4 million downloads a day or whatever they have, but it sure would be nice to think that there's a real solid audience out there enjoying these things. And I guess even if there isn't, I'm going to keep doing them because I love doing this, and it's just enjoyment for me, and I get to meet fascinating people and force them to talk to me for an hour and a half. And that's always good. Well, good for me. Thank you to my wonderful wife, Claire McCullough, for being my announcer. Thanks to Rob Clearfield and Gary Rand for writing my great theme music fore and aft. And thanks to James Hutchins for designing both my websites, frankthompson.tv and thecommentarytrack.com. I hope that you'll visit them both. I've just done a little bit of tweaking on frankthompson.tv, and there are a few new things there. And, of course, my holiday letter is coming up in the next few weeks, and you don't want to miss that because I have perplexed people from coast to coast with that thing over the years. I think this is like the 12th year I've done it, so it's 12 years of perplexing and puzzling people. That's my motto. So I will be back to perplex you again next week. And in the meantime, don't you worry. We'll fix it in post.